If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today's show features Seth's interviews with Comedy Central's Jordan Klepper and former White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest, both of whom take a few more questions backstage just for this podcast. But first, Seth takes a closer look at Trump's feud with the NFL.
The Trump administration is dealing with crises both natural and of its own making, from hurricanes to a series of scandals involving cabinet members. So naturally, President Trump spent the weekend attacking athletes for peacefully protesting police brutality. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Tensions with North Korea over its nuclear program are escalating, and there's currently an urgent humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico, where more than 3 million American citizens are currently without power after Hurricane Maria. So President Trump decided what our nation needed most this past weekend was one more thing for us to deal with.
President Donald Trump says athletes who take a knee during the national anthem should be fired.
It all started on Friday when President Trump went on a tear during a rally in Alabama. Here's a reminder of what he said, and I should warn you, some, especially young ones in the room, are going to find this language offensive.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
Let's just take a step back and consider how embarrassing it is that news anchors now have to introduce comments from the president by warning little children to leave the room. Donald Trump is our first NC-17 president. And it's not even a good NC-17 movie. Trump is basically the showgirls of presidents. Trump's presidential library is going to be in the back of a video store where they keep all the pornos. You're going to have to enter through a beaded curtain.
You guys got the State of the Union back here?
Trump's unhinged rant only got worse from there when he bizarrely suggested that NFL ratings were down because people would rather watch him.
The NFL ratings are down massively. Now, the number one reason happens to be that they like watching what's happening on, you know, with yours truly.
That's right. In Donald Trump's mind, people are turning off NFL games, gathering their friends, and ordering pizza to watch an out-of-shape blowhard shuffle around like he got separated from a tour group. But when you think about it, Trump is better than the NFL because with Trump, you get all of the concussions with none of the hitting. Trump talks like he just got his bell rung. Someone should always be checking his eyes with a pen flashlight. How many fingers am I holding up?
3 million illegal voters.
This guy's done for the day. This guy's done for the day. Trump then went on to claim that the other reason ratings are down is that viewers are turning off games when they see players kneel during the anthem.
But you know what's hurting the game more than that? When people like yourselves turn on television and you see those people taking the knee when they're playing our great national anthem.
Sorry, what? What was that hand motion? Can we see that again? Does he turn his TV off by stabbing it? Or is that just him poking his butler to make him change it?
I don't like this anymore. Turn it off, Jeeves!
Very well, sir, very well.
Trump then doubled down on his claim about the ratings and attendance, tweeting over the weekend, "If NFL fans refuse to go to games until players stop disrespecting our flag and country, you will see change take place fast, fire or suspend." And by asking fans to boycott the league, Trump was attacking the pocketbook of many who would use their pocketbooks to help Trump.
Mr. Trump's criticism led to sideline demonstrations yesterday at stadiums across the country.
During the anthem, players joined arms, sat or knelt. Even Redskins owner Dan Snyder, a Trump supporter, joined in. Shahid Khan, the league's only Muslim owner and a Trump supporter, locked arms with his team, the Jacksonville Jaguars.
New England Patriots owner Bob Kraft, who gave Mr. Trump a Super Bowl ring and contributed to his campaign, says he was deeply disappointed by the president's comments.
He gave Trump a Super Bowl ring, and now Trump is attacking the NFL. This is a reminder that supporting Trump is a lot like robbing a bank. Just when you think you got away with it, the dye pack explodes. By now, it should be clear to everyone who Donald Trump is and what he represents. When black athletes peacefully protest racism and police brutality, Trump has no trouble summoning his outrage. But when white supremacists march with Nazi flags and Confederate flags through the streets of an American city, he equivocates and then defends them. But Trump wasn't content to feud with just one massively popular sports league this weekend. He decided to tangle with the NBA as well after seeing a Fox & Friends segment on Steph Curry's decision not to go to the White House with the Golden State Warriors. Trump saw that and tweeted, "Going to the White House is considered a great honor for a championship team. Stephen Curry is hesitating, therefore, invitation is withdrawn." But this prompted a response from LeBron James himself, who tweeted at Trump, "You bum." Steph Curry already said he ain't going. So therefore, ain't no infight. Going to the White House was a great honor until you showed up. Is there anything better than calling Donald Trump a bum? Bum is such a great old-timey sports insult. He talks about the president the way guys in fedoras used to talk about a 42-year-old overweight boxer. He's a bum. There were so many memorable responses to the president's comments this weekend, but if you were angry and frustrated, you might have found some catharsis in this tweet from Buffalo Bills running back LeSean McCoy, who wrote, "It's really sad, man. Our president is an ass." I have to say, the most devastating part of that is the ellipsis. You can almost see McCoy tenting his fingertips and going, how shall I put this? I know, accurately. Because you think he's gearing up for a longer rant, and then he just calls the president an ass. That's like sending a friend a text that says, "I have something very important I need to tell you," then typing for 10 minutes so all they see are dots, and then following up with, "You suck." Trump, of course, only dug in after that, obsessively tweeting over the weekend about sports, despite tweeting not once about the crisis in Puerto Rico. On Saturday, he wrote, "If a player wants the privilege of making millions of dollars in the NFL or other leagues, he or she should not be allowed to disrespect our great American flag." Okay, first of all, it's not a privilege. The players are the sport, and without them, there is no league. There's a reason DirecTV has a red zone channel and not an owner's box channel. And second, it wasn't just athletes protesting police brutality who stood up against Trump this weekend. He also earned harsh rebukes from football analysts who aren't exactly known as radicals.
What would you say to the president about all this stuff?
I would say he should apologize. They're not SOBs. They're smart, thoughtful guys.
When I heard the comments, I was so disappointed because I believe the comments are completely contradictory to what the flag represents.
There was even this comment from Trump supporter Rex Ryan.
"I supported Donald Trump. You know, I sat back and when he asked me to introduce him at a rally, you know, in Buffalo, I did that. But I'm reading these comments and it's appalling to me."
Oh, so you supported Trump and then he let you down? Better cover your eyes. It will go off. Look, These athletes aren't just speaking for themselves. They're using their platform to call attention to racial injustice and speak out for others. And here now to use her platform to do the same, late night writer Amber Ruffin.
Black people, what is wrong with you? I woke up on Saturday and heard Trump is attacking black people. And I was like, he is? And then they were like, verbally. And I was like, oh, thank God. Trump said when people kneel for the national anthem, they should kick that son of a bitch off the field. You know someone is racist when they don't even want black people in their field. And for the record, I would take a knee in a second. Unless a black lady was singing the national anthem, because that is too dang long to be on one knee. Then Trump disinvited Steph Curry to the White House after he said he wasn't going. That's like me saying, Taye Diggs, you can never come over to my house. He wasn't coming over in the first place. Taye, this was just a joke for a television show. Please come to my home anytime you like. If my husband answers the door, don't worry. He knows of our arrangement. I get Taye Diggs, and he gets an hour of silence. People are on Twitter talking about how the players are ungrateful. There is not enough time to unpack why that is a gross thing to say to a black person. Also, how are black people ungrateful when you called the White House a dump? Don't nobody want to eat at your dump with you? Also, wants to have dinner with you because no one wants to eat whatever it is you eat because maybe it's the food you eat that makes you look like that. You guys, this is about racial inequality. Look, if you have a problem with black people loudly protesting and silently protesting, then what you have a problem with is black people. What is your ideal form of black protest? Write down our complaints, put them in a bottle, and throw them in the ocean? Wouldn't you like it if our complaints were mournfully sung in an old Negro spiritual?
My president's a white supremacist. If he keeps on a-tweeting, I'm a-gonna be pissed.
Oh, my God, that does make me feel better. Look, let me be clear about what is happening here. Trump is trying to make sure to let black people know that if we don't fall in line, we will be punished. Well, guess what? If slavery didn't break us, this idiot certainly can't, you raggedy fool. Back to you, Seth.
Amber Ruffin, everybody! This weekend was in many ways the perfect distillation of Trump's presidency, feeding his base racial and cultural resentments in order to keep them on his side as his team of corrupt authoritarians tries to swindle hardworking Americans out of their health care. Or, you know what? To quote LaShawn McCoy, our president is an ass. This has been a closer look. Our guest is a very funny comedian you know from his work on The Daily Show. His new show, The Opposition, premieres Monday night on Comedy Central. Please welcome to the show, Jordan Klepper, everybody.
Seth, how are you, sir?
Good. I'm so excited for your show. Congratulations on getting a show.
Thank
That's great news.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
And thank you for being here tonight. Although yes. I want to take issue with something. You chose to be here tonight.
Yes.
Tonight is your wedding anniversary.
It is my wedding anniversary. Yeah. Yes. Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah. But I think this might be okay because your wife is also on the show.
Yes. My wife, Laura Great, she is working on the show. In fact, she was working today. So this works out well. We love each other. But we love self-promotion even more.
That's wonderful. So, yeah. That's how you found each
That's
other.
That's how we found each other.
A love of self-promotion.
Yeah, so you can celebrate an anniversary. Yeah,
you guys gave vows to each yourselves.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I promise to make myself look good in your image. Till death do us part. But I'm mostly thinking about me right now.
There you go. So you are doing your show in Manhattan.
Yes.
But I've heard word that you were operating out of a hotel.
We are, yes.
Okay.
The Pennsylvania Hotel.
The Pennsylvania Hotel. Yes, the historic Pennsylvania Hotel.
Oh, yes, right by Penn Station, the sexiest part of New York City. Yeah. If you know anything about New York City, you know you go to Penn Station, you get a slice of pizza, you see some TV, and you sleep in the bed bugs.
Yeah.
It's
Most people walk out of Penn Station and they say, I want a hotel right here.
I never want to leave. Is there a place for political satire around here? Yeah, we actually we toured the hotel. They reconfigured the ballroom to make it a studio. And we walked around, and it had this funny smell. It's like, what is that smell? There was like, oh, there was a food show in here before here. I was like, yeah, what food show? I was like, the worst cooks was in here beforehand. So you can imagine the smell. Like, a food show beforehand is going to smell. The worst cooks still lives in our studio. Yeah.
So you have to overcome that.
Yes.
But you have a great team. You have some Daily Show experience.
Yeah.
On this show, you are playing a character who is alt-right, sort of inspired by Alex Jones, a bit of a conspiracy theorist. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about the character.
Yeah, we're kind of diving into this alt-media landscape, the world of InfoWars and Breitbart, The Blaze. Like, we found, like, this world of, like, paranoid conspiracy that suddenly filters its way down into the mainstream and into the Oval Office. That was kind of the world we wanted to live in.
Yeah, it was a good time for this.
Yeah.
You. I want to talk about it because it's sort of inspired by Alex Jones. And first I want to show, here's a promo for your show, The Opposition.
Who are they? The enemy. Who's the enemy? They are. I already said that. Pay attention. It's time for us to fight back against them because them are fighting against we.
All right, very good.
Good.
Made it super clear.
Very clear.
But then, this seems to be like a gift. Tell me if I'm wrong. Alex Jones saw that promo and did a long piece on it on his show, on his radio show.
He has a lot of content to fill up on that radio show. Yeah, when you do alt-media radio, you're on air for about 20 hours, so if there's something to talk about, you talk about it.
And here's what he had to say about that promo you just saw.
He's up there saying, you got to go through me. And then he'll explain how he politically operates. He's really telling them how to operate, not the way we operate. And then he all says it very disingenuously. So they're there getting their programming on how to attack us while they're learning to hate us, but really they're discovering their identity. This is mind control.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So here you are. Not even an episode into your show, and you have full engagement with your inspiration. It's a great start.
Locked and loaded. And he is right. It is mind control.
Yeah, okay, like, good.
Oh, yeah. Viacom told me we need to get inside the minds of 18 to 23-year-olds, get them engaged in the show so we could sell them fizzy drinks during the advertisements. And he knows. He sees it.
Then that thing.
Yes, yes. He knows what he's doing. He's signaling me. He knows. He wants me to bring it on, and you know what? I'm happy.
There you go. Yeah. And now genuinely you have been engaging a lot, or I should say not engaging, but doing a lot of research about this world that you want to talk about. And what is it? You must have uncovered some things, some actual genuine ways that people interact or are drawn to the kind of media that you're talking about.
Well, I do think when you get on the fringe with a lot of these media sources or just news in general, I think what we're starting to respond to is how it's not necessarily the facts that these people are pulling from. The veracity and the validity that they get is how they experience the facts. So, like, even Alex Jones does this on his show, other people as well. It's not about, like, I heard this fact. It's like, I experienced this. I got this email. I saw this thing. So an anecdote suddenly becomes a fact, then it becomes a conspiracy, and it becomes, through a little bit of paranoia, then becomes something that other people begin to follow. And so you just start to see this path towards chaos, and then you make a show about it.
Yeah. In making the show about it, is it any less chaotic to you? Do you sort of feel like you're getting your head around it? Or are in your research, do you have a sense of, this is worse than I thought?
I think you start to wrap your head around it. I mean, I would guess it's cathartic to come to work and have a bunch of writers and be like, did you see this thing? Are you experiencing this? And, like, to be able to hash that out and try to make sense of it through a show later in the day, I think is something that we all gain something from.
Yes. You will learn once you start doing the show that the off weeks are the hard weeks because that's when you will go crazy.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yes.
Because then the news happens and you have nowhere to talk about it, and so you just sort of wander around Manhattan talking out loud. And
just start screaming. Yeah. That's when I celebrate my anniversary with my wife.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes.
You came from Chicago, much
yes.
like me. You were an improviser. Mm-hmm. Do you have any memories of your favorite times in Chicago, your favorite shows?
Favorite shows? Probably my favorite improv show in Chicago. I was in a group called American Dream, which was a lovely group of people. And we did a bunch of weird, crazy shows. And the one that stands out is one of our members showed up late because every improviser works two different jobs, was exhausted and needed to sleep. So we did an entire show at I.O., where he went to sleep on stage, and we decided just to whisper the entire show. We asked the audience not to laugh, but to raise their hands. And they did. And so we did this entire show where people were, instead of laughing, were raising their hands. And you started to see people. There was an improviser that came in halfway through and just saw a bunch of people raising their hands and us whispering. It was like, this feels like a cult. And it was an improv show, so he was right.
Yeah, he was right. Well, you've come a long way from that. And congratulations. I really can't wait for Monday. Thanks so much for being here, Jordan.
I appreciate it.
Jordan Klepper, everybody. The Opposition premieres Monday night at Comedy Central.
Hey, everybody, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Jordan Klepper.
Hey, Henry, good to see you.
Host of The Opposition. It's so good to see you. So you were just telling the story with Seth about this person who fell asleep in your group, American Dream, in Chicago. That person was Piero Procaccini, one of my favorite people, one of my early improv coaches. And that's why I know you a little bit from Chicago. When did you come to Chicago? I know you grew up in Michigan. Why did you go to Chicago, and when did you go to Chicago?
I grew up in Kalamazoo, went to college there as well, and kind of got the improv bug. And so around 2000, 2001, I made my way over to Chicago. I kind of fell in love with IO Chicago and Second City over there and wanted to give it a shot. And so I stumbled on over there right after college, found a place to live, took a bunch of classes, and got in the game.
You hosted a late night show at IO.
I did, yes. The Late Night Late Show, which was like, I played a character named Mark Luge. Every week's was like a themed late night show with like real guests, but a bunch of weird characters. And it was a weird circus.
Yeah. How did that experience, or did that experience help at all when you're creating your actual TV late night show?
Well, I mean, I think it was a good 12 years later when I did the TV version of it all, but it immediately made me grow up in Chicago because you had to add structure to an improv idea. You had to break out bits and how that would work. And I had to get comfortable behind a desk and not only trying to be a funny person within it, but also be a person who like guided guests through. So immediately I started to figure out a little bit about what that skill set was.
So I want to ask about your new show, The Opposition, which will have premiered. It's Friday night right now. Your show premieres Monday. People will be hearing this after your show has already premiered. Let's just say it's going great.
I hope they watched it. I hope you liked it.
It's been really good so far. Yes. Yeah, it's been awesome.
Yeah, boy, it went so well. What a Monday night.
It's been really good. What a Monday. And then just from there.
Oh, and just, it kept
to Tuesday?
Going. Tuesday, yes.
And by Thursday.
Oh, boy, what a Thursday.
Thursday was great. Great guest, great comedy. Can you explain, for maybe the people who have not seen it yet, even though it's on the air now when you're listening, what the show consists of, what it looks like?
Yeah, the show is a satirical news show, a late night show as well. But we wanted to live sort of in this world of alt media. And so I am the host. I kind of fashion myself off of an Alex Jones. I'm calling him Alex Jones meets Garrison Keillor. So he lives in this world of paranoia and believing the only truth that he knows is the truth that exists. But I kind of add my own little spin and my own Jordan Klepperness to it. And so it's the world of conspiracy. It's the world of fake news. It's sadly the world we're in right now.
Yeah. So, yes, that is 100% true. So a lot of late night shows change over time. Have you guys kind of built in space to kind of learn and evolve as the show goes on? Like, how
Henry,
do you kind of
we
think
have
about
to change
that?
Now, Henry? Like, we're just getting this thing up. It's Thursday night. We've only had three shows.
But they've been great shows. But I'm wondering, like, when you're starting out with a show like this, if you kind of think about what it will be like day one and how it will evolve and if – or maybe you're not even there. It's just let's as much as we can for Monday.
No, I would say no. We totally do think about that. I think there's what you quickly realize is you have to build the machine to be able to – put out a show every night.
Yeah.
And I think like, and there's certain risks you can take when you have enough time to take those risks. And like, even it's risks with graphics, it's risks with the ways in which you position a show or try big stunts. Mm-hmm. And those are things that like, there are some things we're going to try right now. And there's some things that I think once we figure out other elements, it's going to open up new things and new toys. And you know, we've had some test shows, so we've gotten to experience the things that we like about the show. And I think you can already tell it's like, we're going to get such feedback over the first few weeks of shows that it'll have to grow.
What do the test shows look like? Like, what have you been doing over the past month to build the show before you're actually on air?
Well, they initially looked like me and somebody printing out pictures to hold up next to me in a conference room. So we just tried to write shows every day, get it going, do it in a conference room, make it feel like high school theater. And then over the last week and a half, we actually got an audience in and started to play with that. And so adding that polish of graphics, audience, how we respond to it. So like, it keeps evolving and changing depending as quite literally the venue gets bigger.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on what's been an amazing run these past few days since the show's already been on the air. It's so good seeing you, and thank you so
Henry,
much.
It's great to see you. Congratulations on this. This is awesome.
It's been so much fun, and go enjoy your wedding anniversary. Get out of here. Get out of here.
I'm out of here. Thank you.
Thanks, Jordan.
Our guest served as press secretary for President Obama. He is currently a political analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. Please welcome to the show, Josh Earnest, everybody. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
I'm so happy to
this
have you. I want to start by saying it strikes me that being a press secretary is difficult no matter who the president is. It seems the hardest part now for, be it Sean Spicer before or Sarah Huckabee Sanders now, is that President Trump is watching the press conference in real time.
Yes.
Was that the case with President Obama? Was he watching the press conferences?
I did not have an audience of one that some of my successors have had. In fact, when President Obama offered me the job in the Oval Office, he said there were two things I needed to know. And the first one was, I'm not going to watch your briefing every day. Presumably, he's got better things to do. He is, after all, the president of the United States.
And isn't it good that there are better things to do than watch a press conference?
Well, I mean, the irony is this. The average American has better things to do than to watch the White House briefing. You would think the leader of the free world would have something better.
Yeah, we don't have time to watch them.
Right, I don't. Yeah. I don't.
And then it also seems that they have had to explain policy that has been expressed in tweets, which is, or they're short. They're very small and short. And they're not a place to explain policy, and then they have to go out and defend them. Do you have great relief that that was not how it was for you?
Yeah, look, President Obama took very seriously the responsibility that he had to go and make an argument. He had a vision about where he wanted to take the country. And, look, the sense that you have with President Trump is that he is constantly freelancing, that it's always sort of extemporaneous, and you never really know what's going to happen.
No,
and
I agree.
What that means is that there's not really any substance there. So when it looks like the spokesperson is having a hard time defending something in this White House, it's because there's actually nothing to defend.
Now, I have heard that President Obama told you his door was always open if you needed policy explained before going to the podium.
Right, exactly.
And so to what you just said, do you think that ultimately door open or door closed, there are no answers in that office?
This was one of the two things that President Obama told me. He said, first, he wasn't going to watch the briefing. And the second thing he said was, if there's ever something that you absolutely need to know before you go out to do the briefing, then you need to come and talk to me. Come find me. I will stop what I'm doing to spend 5 minutes talking to you about what you need to know. And so often that is, people would ask me, what did President Obama mean when he said X? Or what did President Obama mean when he said Y? What better way to find that out than to actually go and talk to the president? And so that meant journalists knew they could count on me conveying to them reliable information about what the president actually thought. This administration, it's not clear that President Trump has invested in his surrogates in a way that will let them walk in the door. And it's also not clear that he wouldn't change his mind as soon as they walked out the door. So I'm not really sure it would do them that much good to go in there in the first place.
Right. Or that the opinion of what they said would change or be received negatively and he would throw them under the bus, which seems like it happens a great deal.
Look, I mean, one of the things and this is particularly true with Mr. Spicer, that he looked like he was in a constant state of fear of being fired.
Yeah.
Because he knew the other guy was watching the television, and he was performing for that one person. And if he wasn't up to snuff, his job was constantly hanging by a thread. And you can't succeed doing any job in America if you're constantly worried that
also,
the one false move is going to...
Also, why worry? Everyone's eventually going to get fired. It's not like there's any lifetime appointments in the Trump administration.
That is true.
So I want to ask about this. One of the things President Obama said when he came into office was he was going to have the most transparent administration ever. That was his wall. There's been multiple studies that said as far as freedom of information requests, they were fulfilled less under President Obama than they had been under previous administrations. Did he fail to live up to that transparency? Yeah. And more so, did he establish a new norm that now when you have a president that has opposite politics of you, is going to take advantage of?
Yeah, listen, this was the subject of a lot of debate in the briefing room when I was the press secretary. And the truth is, President Obama was, in fact, the most transparent president in history.
What metrics are you using?
Well, there are a variety of ways to evaluate this.
And see, this is where you're a good press secretary again. Because I see, like, you're not going to tell me any lies, but I feel like you're going to tell a different truth than the one I'm asking about.
Well, I think we can agree that there are different ways to evaluate what
Let's just do the freedom of information request. I mean, do you feel like in regards to that, he was as transparent as he could have been?
What I can tell you is that there is no presidential directive that came down to any agency that said, you should make it really hard to respond to Freedom of Information Act requests. So the truth is, these agencies all have day jobs. They all have responsibilities to protect our air and water, to provide health care to people, to go and prevent terrorist attacks from occurring on American soil. It's not surprising that the fulfillment of Freedom of Information Act requests is a little bit of a bureaucratic backwater. So it's not like we have the A team that's responding to Freedom of Information Act requests. They are, those are the people that are on the front lines. When it comes to fulfilling Freedom of Information Act requests, More than 90% of the Freedom of Information Act requests that were filed with the Obama administration got a response and got some of the information, at least some of the information that was requested. So
it is, I do want to call it out, because you said at least some of the information. They were more highly censored than had been previous informations. And sometimes the response was, and again, 90% of the time they got a response, sometimes the response was, we can't find that.
Well, the 10% was the we don't have anything for you. But look, there was a good faith effort that was made to provide this information. I think the other thing that the Obama administration pioneered was actually using technology to self-disclose information and information that had never been disclosed before. The best example of this is the entry logs in the White House. People who walk in the White House, if you have a meeting with the president or some other member of the White House staff, for the 43 presidents before Barack Obama, that was information that had not been public. In fact, the Bush administration actually went to the Supreme Court to try to prevent the release of this information. This is something that the Obama administration did voluntarily every quarter. And it won't surprise you to hear that the Trump administration rolled back that progress for transparency.
Well, to be fair, it made sense that President Obama would do it because cool people showed up all the time. I feel like he'd want to be like, there's Jay-Z and Beyonce. They showed up. So it makes sense.
He didn't have that going for him. It wasn't Kid Rock and Sarah Palin.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. There you go. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. Josh Earnest, everybody.
Hi, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Josh Earnest, one of Obama's press secretaries. Okay, first I want to ask you, after going into the briefing room 354, is that right? 354 times?
I think that's right. I haven't checked lately, but it's something like that, yes.
350 sometimes. What was it like going into a late night talk show room? That must be quite different for you.
Well, there are two main differences.
Okay.
The first is...
This is a very press secretary answer already.
Well, I know. It's sort of... The first is that it's... The studio audience makes a big difference.
Totally.
When you walk into the briefing room, you're looking at a sea of skeptical faces.
Yeah, they're not cheering for you.
Yes, but here everybody's cheering for you and laughing along with you and clapping. Yeah. And so that makes it much more fun.
Right.
The second part is the pressure to do comedy is different than the pressure to perform on the international stage and not accidentally declare war on Canada or something.
yeah. Lower stakes.
Exactly.
Okay. I want to ask you about the White House flak jacket, which is this legendary thing. I think a lot of us know it from The West Wing. But it's gone missing, I've read. What's the latest on this?
So the latest on this is that the flak jacket, as I understand, although I haven't been able to check, is still hanging in the closet in the press secretary's office.
Okay.
It certainly was there on January 19th when I walked out the door. Apparently it is still there. But there is another tradition that I actually only recently became aware of, which is that press secretaries have traditionally written a note to their successor, wishing them well and offering them a piece of advice about how to succeed in a high-profile job. And apparently the tradition, when I wrote my note to Sean Spicer, as I did, as my predecessors have done.
Will you say what you said? Is that a private between press secretaries?
It's a private thing.
Sure.
I don't remember exactly word for word what I said, but I left it on the desk so that when he would walk in the room for the first time, he would see it. But apparently there was a tradition of tucking those notes into the pocket of the flak jacket. And the idea was that the incoming press secretary would not just benefit from a letter from their immediate predecessor, but they would get this wealth of knowledge of all of the previous notes.
Smart.
But the flak jacket, the pockets of the flak jacket were empty when I got there. So I was just winging it.
Fantastic. Can you tell me about a day in the life? I know it's kind of a simple or basic kind of question.
Yeah.
But what's your day like? And I'm sure the days change quite often.
That's right.
According to the news.
That's right. There was no typical day.
Yeah.
But in general, my day was organized around the press briefing. Mm-hmm. And the press briefing is the occasion when the press secretary walks out into the James Brady briefing room in the White House and answers on the record, on camera, before the White House press corps, all the questions that they have to ask for that day. And, when I was in the White House, we basically did a briefing every single day that President Obama was in town and not taking questions himself, which meant that we ended up briefing generally four or five times a week. So if the president had a day trip somewhere, then we obviously would not do the briefing that day.
Sure.
And so my schedule was oriented around that. I would get up early in the morning, try and read the clips, and I read the news in a very different way than the typical person does. I didn't just read what was interesting to me. Mm-hmm. I would read what I thought would be interesting to the White House press corps
to try
to anticipate what kinds of questions they would have.
Right.
I would go to the senior staff meeting in the chief of staff's office, that got steadily later in the, as the presidency went later. So it started out at 7:45, and by the end, we were doing it at 8:15 or 8:30. And I used that as an opportunity to really prepare for the briefing. Yeah. That if I saw things that were in the newspaper that day that I wasn't quite sure about, then I had sitting around the table the chief of staff of the White House, the president's national security advisor,
right,
the secretary of the treasury, the director of the National Economic Council, the legislative affairs director, all those people would be in that meeting. And so invariably, if I read something in the newspaper that was new to me or a surprise, I could ask them to explain it to me. Uh-huh. And so that was a real asset that I could bring. And that actually won me a lot of credibility with reporters because they knew that I was using the access that I had to my White House staff to try to get them answers and to make the best possible case about what the White House was doing.
Yeah, totally.
So after doing that meeting, then you know, later in the morning, I would spend time with my staff. I had spokespeople who handled a range of domestic issues, and we'd spend 45 minutes going through what news was made that day by the administration, what announcements we'd made, what was in the newspaper, and then what was on the minds of reporters that day.
Right.
And then I do the same thing with the foreign policy staff at the National Security Council. They divide up the world. And after a couple of hours of spending of doing that prep, then I do the briefing.
That's incredible. It is so much prep for how long are the briefings? An hour?
Generally around an hour, sometimes a little longer, sometimes a little less.
Yeah. One of the main differences on policy between the Obama White House and the Trump White House is the U.S.'s approach to Russia. Yeah. You got in trouble with the Russian embassy because of something you said in the briefing room. Can you tell us about
this? I did. There was Russia intervened militarily in Syria in the fall of 2015. And this is very disconcerting to the world because it foretold a ramped up escalation of military involvement in an already very violent, bloody place.
Yeah.
And Russia made the case that they were intervening in Syria because they were trying to fight terrorism. Now, the truth of the matter is Russia was intervening in Syria because Syria had been a client state of theirs for at least a generation.
Right.
And the regime was on the verge of crumbling. So Russia was in there to prop them up. One of their military interventions was to deploy to Syria an advanced anti-aircraft missile system. Mm-hmm. And someone at the briefing, a reporter, asked me about this decision that the Russians had made to deploy the system. And I offhandedly said, that is kind of curious. I noticed that development too. When you consider that the Russians claim that their military intervention is focused on fighting terrorism, I wasn't aware that ISIL had an air force. So this elicited some chuckles in the briefing room. Yeah. It was me poking fun at the at the propaganda and lack of honesty on the part of the Russians. The Russians did not think it was very funny. And later that day, the Russian embassy in the United States tweeted an image that they had mocked up. This was a rectangular image. Mm-hmm. The top left-hand corner was an image of me standing at the White House podium. The bottom right-hand corner was a picture of this anti-aircraft missile system, and the image was oriented so that the anti-aircraft missile system was aimed at my head.
Yeah, this is not a hard image to find.
It is.
I think you can Google Josh Earnest missiles.
And it pops right up, huh?
It should pop right up, yeah.
That is not a piece of information I needed to know today. the next day, sure enough, somebody asked me at the briefing what my reaction was to that image. And I said, look, I understand that when I'm standing up here, I'm not just representing the president, but I'm a representative and a symbol of the United States of America. And so the hostility that the Russians are expressing is something that I'm trying not to take personally, and I don't. But it also would be fine with me if they never do that again.
Sure.
And they didn't. But it does sort of... it is a vivid reminder of the stakes of what goes on in the briefing room, what is said by the person behind the podium. But it's also a vivid reminder that the briefing room is, and the daily briefing is about a lot more than just the press secretary.
Totally.
It's about the policies of the administration. It's about our national security. It's about these big topics. It's important when you're taking on a big job like that, that you don't get swallowed up in it and you don't sort of lose sight of the fact that for all of the time that your face is on television, it's not about you.
Right. Well, let me ask you a final question that gets to this point a little bit. President Trump, when he was candidate Trump, he was kind of rewarded from breaking the general rules of political messaging. I mean, you're a communications expert. The things he did were anathema to what a candidate is supposed to do, but he was rewarded for it. He won. Can you talk about the dangers of being so undisciplined
from the White House when you were the head of the government.
Yeah. Well, listen, the rest of the world looks at the United States as a source of stability. And since World War II, the United States, working closely with our allies in Europe, but also in Asia, have essentially been the cornerstone of keeping the peace around the world. And there are places where, you know, things have flared up. And, you know, those flare-ups have resulted in a significant loss of life, but not the same kind of global conflict that we saw in World War I and World War II. So these alliances and this source of stability is critically important to our national security and to our prosperity. And for the Commander-in-Chief of the United States, for the leader of the free world to introduce so much uncertainty it's destabilizing and it's disconcerting and it's not good for our national security. It's not good for our economy. And it is something that worries our allies and it emboldens our adversaries because countries like China that are not allies of the United States, that are adversaries of us, that there are certain situations where we can get along with them, certain situations where we're in conflict. When there are countries in Asia that they are looking to partner with at the expense of the United States, it's easy for them to go to those countries and say, you're going to rely on the United States of America led by President Donald J. Trump to defend you and to look out for your interests? That's the person that you're going to trust? That's the person that you're going to put faith in? Or why don't you take a look at us? We're a growing country, and we've got an interest in trying to get along with you and trying to make progress that benefits us. And the truth is that puts the United States at a disadvantage, and we are less well off because of it. And that's not the kind of thing that makes a headline in a newspaper. It's not the kind of thing that you can notice overnight. But certainly over the long term, it is detrimental to our national security and it's detrimental to our influence around the globe.
As fascinating and depressing in many ways. I want to thank you for your service to the country and for being here. It was such a pleasure chatting with you. And thank you so much for your time. Really,
thank you, Henry.
It's
an honor to do the job as press secretary. And it's a heck of a lot of fun to be with you.
I hope this was a little more fun. Thanks again.
Take it easy.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.